Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to The Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 122.
Yes, it is.
Many, many episodes have been done and will be done.
121, in fact.
Yes. That's a big number. Makes a girl think.
Does it? Does it really struggle going past 121?
Oh, I struggle with numbers constantly.
Okay.
Oh, I'm numerically dyslexic. Nah, just a bit thick.
Nah.
Others maybe.
Just can't count.
The numbers, they trouble me. How are you, Nick?
I'm buying you an abacus for your birthday.
Oh, good.
So there we go.
What's an abacus?
Problem
I
solved.
I don't understand the clickety-clackety.
Clickety-clackety.
Which? How are you, Nick, though?
I'm all right. It's still holiday.
Oh, you are on holiday. So
holidays.
If anyone hasn't heard across the universe, Nick has a week off. He has the place to himself.
I'm doing nothing.
And he's loving it.
Mm-hmm. Bloody marvellous.
There's nothing quite like a holiday just at home where you're beholden to no one.
Exactly.
There's no pressure to do anything or go anywhere until I come hammering on your door and say, do a podcast.
Until that becomes. But until then, it's great.
How is the day drinking going?
It's actually pretty good so far. This is the first drink I've had all day.
You're not doing holidays right.
I had a cider at lunchtime yesterday. That was it. That's all I drank yesterday.
I'm drunk right now.
Yeah, you're always drunk.
I've been working. It did not go well.
That's just you, though. But no, I've been very restrained, I feel.
Okay. Well, in your relaxed state, any poisonings this week?
No, far too relaxed for such things.
Yes.
Can't mean that involves planning and shovels and all sorts of things. So I just can't be doing all that.
There needs to be some sort of system of sort of window-based hurling of poison and see what happens.
Well, the potential was I could open my front windows and just sort of set up some sort of like Mrs. Lovett pie shop in the window full of poisoned pies. That could have been interesting.
Disturbing as well.
Disturbing, but also that involves a lot of effort.
Wonderful. I look forward to Nick's pie shop as a small subsidiary of the finishing school.
Yeah. Always ideas sound great. You have all these grand plans, but then they're like, oh, I've got to do stuff. If I have to do that thing, then I'm going to have to move. Possibly going to have to stand up.
Very hard life.
It is a hard life, so then, you know.
To be fair, though, your plans for a finishing school and a Mrs. Lovett-style pie shop are much more ambitious than the rest of us.
But this is perhaps where I'm going wrong.
I plan to get cheese. That's mainly the extent
of
it.
I think I need to limit the ambitions.
Well, speaking of being entrepreneurial in a very dark way and drinking during the day, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious new Patreon subscribers.
Absolutely. I mean, I do hope they have some lovely day drinks on the go. We must say thank you very much for joining us to Catherine Cotton Bitteridge.
Thank you so much,
thank
Catherine.
Thank you very much this week.
And thank you to everyone who has resubscribed, updating their Patreon. We've had a few back with us, and also who have upgraded to Cyanide Connoisseurs for extra episodes every month and fabulous, fabulous cocktails. We love you. You're very, very sexy.
Yes.
It's very difficult to deal with at times, how sexy our Patreons are.
It's blindingly so sometimes.
It is. We also have a shout out this week from one of our darling, darling Patreon subscribers. This is a shout out for Nicola, who has messaged us on Patreon. So Nicola and her family have had a very, very tough few weeks. Her niece, Scout, has been diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, going through some great care. But her and her five-year-old niece, Adeline, they both are massive fans of the show. They have actually gotten very used to listening to The Poisoner's Cabinet to the extent that the five-year-old, and I worry for them, has been telling their husband all about us two, talking about what we say. Occasionally we'll shake up a storm.
Nice.
With whatever she's playing with.
Excellent.
Both been listening religiously through a very, very difficult time. We just want to say that both of you are so brave. You are so loved by your family and you're so loved by us. You are not the greatest poison of them all.
How kind you are.
So thank you both for being huge fans of the show. Thank you to Nicola. And we look forward to bringing you even more episodes in the future. Well, Nick, are you ready?
Yeah, I believe so.
To drink cocktails and talk about poison?
That's a good opportunity to do so.
Or you drink poison and talk about cocktails.
That is an equally good opportunity to do that.
On your holiday?
Well, this is true. This is very true.
You holiday. Go out with a bang.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah.
Should we go with the first one?
I feel holiday cocktails are appropriate.
Oh, good. Let's go with the first one. Hooray, hooray, hooray. And also, holiday cocktails. Now you've just got Club Tropicana playing in my head now. I'm like, ooh, are we going to have some tiki drinks? Are we going to have some drinks by the pool? No.
Yeah, my great expansive pool that I have out
there. Exactly. It's overlooked by the magical veranda. Okay, should we go with the first one?
Let's go with the first one.
Yay! Hooray, hooray, hooray. It is my story this week, but we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, every week we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell, and it will flavour our cocktail of the week. So my story, my pick this week, and this week's secret ingredient, Nick, is... Lettuce.
Classic cocktail ingredient.
It's not just because I'm healthy eating at the moment and it permeates my brain. Lettuce, Nick.
Yeah.
For a cocktail.
You don't make these things easy, it has to be said.
Now, I gave you two other options.
Yeah, which were equally shite.
No. I still insist that things could have been done.
Really? But they could have been done, but you would have moaned. You're going to moan at this.
I'm sure I will. This is the challenge that I give you, dear.
Yeah, absolutely. It's getting more and more difficult each week.
But lettuce, what have you
come
up with?
Well, I mean, to be honest, these days it's more of a word association game that I'm playing, really, to try and find out a cocktail that is appropriate. Now, unsurprisingly, there's not that many lettucey cocktails.
Yes.
I got some celery bitters. I thought that's sort of lettuce adjacent.
That's not lettuce.
What exactly?
Well, it's a salad, is it?
It's a salad-y thing.
Is a celery a lettuce?
No.
No, it's not. I knew that.
It's salad adjacent.
So you're wandering into lettuce, that means salad, and salad is on the side of a steak, and steak you sometimes have with red wine. There we go.
Damn. I knew I missed a trick. So what I found an interesting one.
Oh, God.
Interesting one when having an iceberg.
Okay, that I don't mind at all.
Are you happy with that one?
I'm happy with that word association because it's iceberg, lettuce. Oh my God. That terrible, terrible lettuce that we buy and it rots at the bottom of your crisper.
It could have been fridge as an ingredient. Ooh. From the molten lettuce that is in the back of my fridge.
Oh, God.
but I decided against that.
I mean, if you are a child of the 80s, let's face it, there was no rocket that you could just buy. No. Or watercress or spinach even was a commodity that was dealt on street corners. No, all you had as options for lettuce was the iceberg lettuce. And then it just went brown and you had to peel away to the good stuff if you ever wanted a salad.
The good
posh.
Stuff is, yeah.
Okay, an iceberg. Not heard of it, but I am ready for a cocktail.
I'm glad.
I think it is high time for us to sail towards the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
Well, Nick, an iceberg, you say. Now, I heard noises in the kitchen.
Did you? I apologise.
I frequently hear noises from you. Mainly you going, oh God, why? Why? My eyes.
Frequently.
But I heard a blendy sound.
A blendy sound.
And the concoction in front of us does look blended.
Yep.
It looks a little bit like gazpacho, I'm not going to lie. I don't know what this is.
Does that have iceberg in it? Does that have lettuce in it?
Well, it does have a bit
of salad.
Well, there we go.
Yeah, it could well be.
Oh, okay. It's slushy and kind of a salmon pink colour. Is there salmon in this?
There's salmon and salad.
Oh, God.
It's going to be a delight.
We don't often have a blended drink.
No. I think potentially the first time ever.
Yeah, I don't think we've done it. No, we must have.
I'm not generally a fan of the blended drink. So we've done a few with like crushed ice, but
yes,
an actual blendy one, I don't know if we have.
Blendy. It is a hot day.
Yeah.
So let's dive in. Okay, I'm scared.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Okay.
Not blended enough. It's got
very
big,
crunchy.
Big chunks of ice in there.
Okay. That's interesting-ish. Hang on. Filtering out the ice here. It's very cold and refreshing. It's got... Okay. It's got flavour.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Not a lot of it.
Harsh.
I'm going to be honest here, yeah. I don't really know what's going on. It's not your finest work.
Harsh.
Did you invent it?
No.
Oh, thank God.
I did not.
Right. Okay, well, then that's fine. You are but the vessel. Well, what do you think?
I mean, yeah, I'm not a huge fan, to be honest. One of the ingredients I did have to slightly make up.
All right, we don't have any vodka, so I've used mustard.
Well, with similar things, but I didn't have Jesus. The precise ingredient.
It's so. It's got an interesting taste to it. It just sort of it's one of those that goes taste then nothing. Hmm.
I'm glad I've slaved all day over this.
Have you?
Yes.
Really? Oh God, I'm sorry.
No, you're not.
No.
No.
You knew what this was. Okay, we'll talk us through it. What should be happening in our faces?
Well, I don't know. As far as I know this, I've never had one before, so I can't tell you.
Okay.
So, tequila. There's tequila.
Okay.
There's some lemon juice. And then two new things.
Two new things.
One of which I spent hours slaving over.
Really?
Yeah.
What is it?
I made... Now, I'm not sure how the pronunciation of this, so... I've heard it different ways. Orgeat syrup.
I have made.
It's O-R-G-E-A-T. Now, I've heard some people pronounce it orgea or...
Orgeat.
Yeah, orgeat. Or orget. Orget. There's loads of different pronunciations. I'm not sure. It is a nut syrup.
Ooh, okay. So, I like nuts.
So this has been made with almond.
Yes, mate.
Which is the traditional sort of almond syrup, but you can also make it with pistachio or hazels or macadamia nuts or any sorts of nuts, really.
Wow.
But it is a nut infused syrup and generally put with either rose water or orange blossom water.
Okay.
Now, I hate rose water, so I use orange blossom water. So basically, you get some sugar and you get some water and you make a syrup, and then you chuck a load of ground, in this case, ground almonds, in until you get like a wallpaper paste. Mm-hmm. And then you leave that to infuse for 5 or 6 hours or whatever, and then strain it through some muslin into a bottle, and then put some rose water and put a bit of vodka, just like half an ounce of vodka, because it helps just keep it a bit longer in the fridge.
Orange blossom.
A teaspoon of orange blossom water. And it's used, strangely you mentioned tiki cocktails, because it is used in a huge amount of tiki cocktails. orgeat syrup.
I see a lot of almond syrup being referred to and those sorts of things. So you've got the orgeat syrup, and what was the other thing?
And then there's the other thing is, what I don't have, is an ingredient called Underberg. Which I think is where the iceberg reference comes to in this, which is a German digestif, basically.
Okay.
So, you know, like the chartreuse, the elixir vegetal we had,
the really uber
strong one. This is much the same, but a German version of it.
Okay.
And you actually buy it in little 20 centilitre bottles.
Wow.
And you're meant to like break the cap off and knock it back in one, like after a meal. 1,000 different herbs and all this sort of stuff. And it's been going since like 17 something or other. And
okay.
And people have started using it because it is such an intense flavouring, using it in cocktails. So this has this Underberg stuff in, which unfortunately I wasn't able to get my hands on in time for the episode. But looking online, the sort of the flavour profile of that is a bit Jaegery, so, but not quite as sweet as Jaeger. Mm. So I actually made a Jaeger Angostura bitter mix.
Yeah.
Really try and get the bitterness that I think is in there, and there's sort of more the sort of complex herbaliness from the Jägermeister.
Ooh.
So I made my own Underberg. If it's anything like it, I have no idea.
An experiment by Nick.
Experiment. And then you're all in there, and then blendy, blendy, blend.
And blendy, blendy, blend. First time in blendy, blendy, blendy.
Yeah.
To your credit, Nick, there is that aftertaste. This is not the sort of cocktail that we're used to, because it is blended. We're used to a lot of spirit forward drinks. We're used to a lot of shaken drinks, stir drinks. With the ice, it does dull the senses, I guess, a little. You're saying
it's
the Jaeger. It's growing on me too, because I've had a few more sips. You've said the Jaeger, and it's not just because you said it. There was that slightly herbally medicinal taste there. I will confess, I can't obviously taste the nut syrup.
No, I can't.
But then again, every single cocktail that I've had that references that, I don't go, ooh, nuts galore.
Yeah.
So maybe it's giving something in the background.
Yeah. The one I've made, I've got like a bottle of it that I made today. It's not overly almondy.
No.
I think I should probably, if I do it again, which I think I might experiment, might toast my almonds first before I grind them.
You could do, yeah.
Because when people talk about it, they say it's like marzipan in a bottle type thing, which this, which what I've made isn't.
Use an almond essence. So, if you're not going to get the real thing, then maybe use a, use the essence of it, because then you've got a little bit of the concentrated flavour along with the almonds in there.
We shall see. If I make it again, I may well do it differently. But
it grows
it's
on
not,
you,
it's not,
it?
It's not horrendous by any means.
The problem with frozen cocktails is that this isn't badly blended at all. It's got a few more shards in it than normal. But even a frozen cocktail, you have to take slowly because you're like, oh, my teeth. It's really not bad because on a hot day, actually, it's grown on me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not overly sweet. When you usually get a blended slushy style drink, it's full of sugar and sweet things. And you're like, you know, no, this is, that's grown on me.
Interesting.
I don't know if I'd make it again, but it's made me think more frozen-y cocktails.
More slushy cocktails.
More slushies. Well, with our icebergs in hand, juggling it from hand to hand, obviously, so we don't get freezer burn, would you like a story, Nick?
I think so. I always finish mine, so.
Well, actually, now you've nearly finished your cocktail. I fear that you might, for this story, want a more spirit-forward drink.
Okay.
A more punchy, oldie-worldy sort of drink. Yes, because of where we're going this week, Nick.
Should I sit in a leather chair by the fire?
Oh, I think you'll want to. Because, Nick, we are investigating a murder in perhaps an unlikely place for murder most foul.
Okay.
Yes, we're off to America.
Okay.
To the great state of Massachusetts.
Ooh, okay.
Where a crime has been committed.
Oh.
At Harvard University.
Oh, have any fancy. Surely not, such things do not occur in such educated establishments.
Indeed, in the hallowed house of learning. Now, over the years, Harvard has had a few brushes with death. Maybe more than have ever been reported, if the conspiracy theorists are right. We must acknowledge anyone who's sort of jumping up and down right now, the terribly sad and very well-documented case of Jane Britton, who was a student in 1969. It was a murder that occurred on campus, unsolved, as it were, lots of theories, possibly a story for Patreon in the future. It's not a particularly jolly one, but it's a big one. But it's not that. It's not that one. Yeah. It's also worth noting, I'm going to go off on a tangent here slightly.
Surely
because
not.
Because of the nature of this job, where you're Googling and you're looking up stuff, technically serial killer, the Unabomber, went to Harvard University. He's an alumni, taught at very prestigious universities before killing people. That's not Harvard's fault, I fear. Though the reason I bring it up is that doing the research around this particular case that we're covering, you Google certain search terms and one came up. Someone at some point typed in, do serial killers go to college?
To learn their skills. Possibly.
Who was looking for the qualification for serial killers? What training is that person after?
It's like the Hogwarts for murderers.
An owl was sent. It did not come back in a good piece. The University of Serial Killers, a fine establishment, hallowed in biology and very good in athletics, not so much in socioeconomics. But no, we're not going to the University of Serial Killers.
Okay.
We're not in the 60s at Harvard. No, we're heading back to another famous murder case associated with Harvard University. Back to 1849, Nick.
Oh.
And we're going to try and find out what on earth has happened to Dr. George Parkman.
What has happened to Dr. George Parkman?
Of Harvard Medical School. Now, Harvard obviously needs no introduction, no matter what side of the pond you sit on. It is the oldest university in the USA, certainly one of the most distinguished and prestigious universities in the world. And how do you get to Harvard, Nick? Money.
Money helps, I feel.
Money, lots and lots of money, people. Of course, anyone hoping to learn there needs to have very good grades, needs to have lots of extracurricular activities on their list when they go into the interview panel. But let's face it, you're far more to be a shoo-in if mummy and daddy teach there or are a legacy and have a massive, massive wallet. No dispersions to anyone who attended Harvard, who is a student there right now. Good on you. It's a fantastic university. But certainly at the time, this prestigious seat of learning is all about the money. Money talks around here. So if being wealthy is a big plus for students at the time, as in you'll get in, imagine how important it is for teachers and people associated with the university.
Have they got to have cash too? They don't buy their jobs, surely.
They may not buy their jobs, but if you are going to be teaching the cream of the crop,
yes,
and you are in Boston, you're also going to need to be the finest of the fine.
Well, absolutely, yes, indeed.
And you're going to need to be able to associate people with bags and bags of cash.
This is true.
You are expected to be elite in their class and the elite of Boston, or at least be able to rub shoulders with them. And our missing man, Dr. George Packman, was not a teacher at Harvard. I'll come on to why he's connected there. He was an elite of Boston. An ex-alumni of Harvard, he was the medical school's largest donor. Now, born in 1790, George Packman was known as one of the Boston Brahmin, or the Boston elite. These are the exceedingly wealthy, wealthy upper class. Families would date back to a founded Boston and all of New England. They are very particular in keeping their English roots alive. So you've got a lot of English-based surnames. Very much playing the role of the English gentleman and lady. Very, very terribly cultured and philanthropic. So the Boston elite are pretty damn powerful at the time. And the Parkmans were one of Boston's richest families. George Parkman's parents were landowners there. He started at Harvard University when he was 15 years old, but that was normal back in the day.
Back then.
He studied medicine there. He also went to the University of Aberdeen. Parkman would later travel and study in France, being very interested in the treatment for mental illness. He was interested in asylums and how they can treat their patients and sort of better foundations and facilities for asylums. He served in the War of 1812 as well as a surgeon. Later went on to push for more comfortable conditions in mental institutions and asylums in America, opened up his home to patients during cholera and smallpox epidemics. This is a very, very wealthy family, a very, very wealthy connected man who is using his skills, his education and his wealth to be very philanthropic. Yeah. Through the community.
Good for him.
Yes. He eventually would take over his family's estate of properties, taking on from his father after he passed away. So you can imagine the wealth there. Equivalent of about $12 million in today's money. So all of that estates, and that's still madness back then. Huge. He sold the land. His family sold the land. That would be the base for the Harvard Medical School. And so he was one of the largest donors of the school. So he was very connected to that area. George Packman was described as tall and lean, with a protruding chin.
Oh, okay.
And he always wore a stovepipe hat.
Nice.
He was described by someone at the time, he abstained while others indulged. He walked while others rode. He worked while others slept.
How dull. God, he sounds like you.
What,
come
walking
on,
everywhere?
We can walk there. No, we can't. It's miles.
I'll only walk there if there's gin at the end of it. I want a reward. On the 23rd of November, Nick, 1849, Dr. George Parkman went to a grocery store and he bought up a quantity of sugar and butter for a delivery to his house. Thanksgiving is coming up.
Okay.
A hearty, hearty meal is in the
Sounds
works.
Like a fancy cake he's got planned.
A big cake, yes. Or yeah. The family just ate butter and sugar to show their fabulous wealth. They were not well people.
he's modelling the children in icing. It's our Thanksgiving traditions.
There will be no diorama, just the children with diabetes. What a delicious dinner must have been in store. Before he left, he turned to the grocer there and he said, can I leave a bag here? Can I leave a bag at the shop? I'm going to collect it later. I don't want to be carrying this around. And the grocer agreed. And inside the bag was a head of lettuce.
Oh, I thought it was going to be a head.
It would have been a great start to the story.
Yeah. Just left a head in a bag in a grocer's.
Very Simpsons reference. A human head. Schumann's head of lettuce. Yes. He left the head of lettuce there with the grocer. And the grocer went about his business, obviously seeing other customers, and waited and waited and waited. But Dr. Parkman never returned for his lettuce.
For the lettuce?
Not for the lettuce. Now, this may sound a little odd, but not too odd. But it was both.
I'm going with a bit odd.
Bit odd. He was not the sort of man to leave his lettuce unattended.
He was known for it. He was known for guarding it jealously with his life.
Carried it around preciously.
All times. Handcuffed to his wrist was the bag, usually.
He'd put lipstick on it. But this is one of the signs, as strange as it is, that a man leaves a bag of lettuce with a grocer and doesn't come back for it. You might just go, okay, it's just a lettuce.
It's a lettuce. Leave the lettuce
it's
alone.
Just a lettuce. Leave the lettuce alone. It's one of the signs that something is amiss. Dr. Parkman is not the sort of man who leaves stuff around. He is very punctual. He returns when he says he's going to come back and pick something up or he's going to see someone. He is there on time. This is cause for concern because people go, okay, why isn't he back? I'm not going to lie to you, Nick. That's the last we see of the lettuce.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I told you it was the most tenuous of the connections, but the lettuce figures highly. You can't leave the lettuce out of the story.
Well, indeed
really.
Not. Absolutely.
The alarm is raised when Parkman does not show up the next morning to get the lettuce. And indeed...
People are putting a lot of faith in this lettuce, or a lot of emphasis on this lettuce.
Well, there's no mobile phones, there's no internet or anything. The guy's like going, he needs his lettuce, surely.
I'm going,
lettuce
oh,
is
he's,
expensive.
He's forgotten his... No, it's not. Not even then was it expensive. He's going, he's forgotten his lettuce.
He's
I know,
powerful
I've
man.
Got I've got a delivery of all this butter and sugar to the house. I'll put the lettuce on the delivery.
He may well have done that, but when he goes round to the house, the family, like, we have not seen him all night. He hasn't been home.
And the lettuce is all gone.
The grocer's eating it. Oh, no.
The lettuce store is empty.
We were to have that for our morning lettuce breakfast. What will little Timmy eat now, apart from sugar and butter? The lettuce was the only vegetable we had to keep us alive. No, the alarm is raised because the lettuce and the fact that the family are screaming, people piece it together. This man must be missing. No, Dr. Parkman is missing. He has not come home. He has not picked up his deliveries. He has not returned. He's not made any of his appointments. Everyone is now worried. And this isn't just anyone. If they hadn't been home, the police might go, oh, okay, give it 24 hours. No. It's George Parkman. This is a man, the Boston elite.
This is a man of importance.
The last time during the initial investigations, it's discovered that Dr. George Parkman was seen was the day before. He was walking up the steps to Harvard Medical School wearing his signature dark suit, his purple satin waistcoat.
Nice.
And his trademark stovepipe hat. And a top hat on top of it.
With a lettuce in it. Lift it up and there's a lettuce underneath. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, sir. Good lettuce to you, sir. But after that, no sign of him. Now the authorities leap into action. All the lettuce is taken from the city. The river is dragged. People are questioned. This is a big deal. What could possibly happen to him? Days pass. Soon, a $3,000 reward is offered for finding him alive. Oh. Information on his whereabouts if he's alive. About 28,000 posters and flyers are posted all over the city. Later, the family even offer $1,000 if anyone finds his body. They're getting so worried about this. The press are, of course, full of rumours and speculations. The first thing they jump on is obviously it's the fault of the Irish.
Oh, of course.
Yep. Always blame us.
Yeah,
Irish immigrants. Oh, they did it. It's always the immigrants. That's it. Yeah, they've robbed him and thrown him into the river. That's the only possible explanation. Case closed. Move on.
Stole his lettuce.
We love a bit of lettuce, to
yeah,
be fair.
Absolutely.
Summer salad. Mm-mm-mm.
Caught up with him down the allotments, they did.
The vast allotments of Boston.
He's actually now a scarecrow, overlooking the lettuce.
It's quite dark. Yeah. I quite like it. At Harvard Medical School, the police began to question anyone who was on the premises at the time that Dr. Parkman had disappeared. He was last seen there, so people must have seen him on site. Who knows? Whatever has befallen him, has it happened at Harvard Medical School? They questioned the janitor, Ephraim Littlefield. Littlefield was a hard-working man. He had been working at Harvard for many, many years, and his job was to clean up. He was also charged to clean the labs, the doctor's rooms. He was also responsible for setting up their samples, getting their labs and their lecture halls ready for the day. He would light the fires. He would have free access around the entire building because that was his job. He had the run of the place. He was very well known and liked by the doctors on campus. He lived on campus as well. He lived in the basement with his wife and children. I don't know what kind of accommodation they had down there. Sounds a bit sad.
Just in a box.
Yes. Later on, his family come to stay for Thanksgiving, and I can't imagine it was a happy Thanksgiving down there.
No, it was definitely the janitor. He did it.
Well, he is known, as I said, by the doctors on campus. Very well known. They all know him in the medical school. For Littlefield was known quietly to have another source of income. He assisted in supplying...
lettuces from his little field that he had out the back.
Even better, cadavers.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that.
Did you?
I did.
The dead lettuce.
The dead lettuce.
Cadavers for dissection. We are in that hallowed time of anatomical study being at its peak. Fresh bodies to cut up, they were in demand. This being Boston, though, is actually surprisingly hard to get dead bodies in Boston. Well, it's hard to get dead bodies anywhere.
Yeah, anywhere. There's...
But very, very predominantly Catholic city. Not many people want to give up their loved ones for study. So there is actually a whole system in Boston, and it ends up in a prosecution about a year before this case happens, of people shipping in or smuggling in dead bodies from New York.
Nice.
But Littlefield has a line in this. He is able to supply dead bodies for an extra $25 a piece.
Bargain.
Tasty. Yeah. Where they come from, we don't know.
No questions asked
whatsoever. So it's perhaps no surprise that after nearly a week since Parkman's disappearance, the police decide they need to question Littlefield.
And he hasn't appeared on the slab at some point.
No. No, they have gone through and searched the whole of the medical school. And you say that, and it's a good point. There is an area where the dead bodies and the bits are discarded.
There must be furnaces or something to get rid of the...
Absolutely.
Yeah, or the offcuts. Or the...
the offcut. It's not a butchery. I can't stress that.
Or the bits that
have been
used and they have no longer usable.
No, there is a furnace, but there is a disposal area. Mm. There is a whole area where the bodies are kept and the bits are disposed of. And yes, Littlefield has access to that. So they are going to be asking him questions. Yes, okay, you have access to dead bodies and you're probably not going to kill the most prominent person in Boston to then sell as a cadaver. But, you know, maybe.
Also killing someone who's giving you cash.
Well, he wasn't giving them cash. The doctors within the medical school.
Remember,
Dr. Parkman, while he's a doctor, he's a donor of the school.
Yes.
He goes there to visit people. He is not working there. So the police, they search Littlefield's quarters, his wife and children living there, but they find nothing. Now, Littlefield is obviously nervous about being questioned by the police. He's got a nice thing going behind the scenes, but he's going to be in the firing line, and he's by no means stupid. It would be wrong to assume that this is just a lowly worker, as the press will later say.
Yeah,
and
the press are
already murmuring about now. Oh, the janitor. Yes, he must be the person to look out. If the police are going to look at him to blame for this disappearance, Littlefield must try to solve the case himself.
Oh, Detective Littlefield.
Oh, yes. Our dear old janitor has noticed someone behaving very oddly around the medical school. John Webster, who was a geology and chemistry lecturer at Harvard. And he was a graduate of the school himself. He also studied in London, practiced medicine. He had published a book. He would eventually become a lecturer at Harvard. He was known to be a decent lecturer, well-liked, not terribly exciting in his field. He was known to be very sort of dull, vanilla, but he loved using pyrotechnics in his lectures.
Who doesn't?
Few fireworks, setting those off, and explosions. He was warned by the equivalent of the dean of Harvard, can you please not do that anymore? It's very dangerous. But he set off fireworks and then would just sort of stand there and be very boring everywhere around the rest of the lecture. So, okay. So, yeah, he wasn't the first lecturer that all the students wanted to attend. This is a weird little side note, actually, about John Webster, that the poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who is a famous poet, he happened to be a neighbour of Webster. And he wrote that one time that he was hosting a dinner party. Webster was hosting a dinner party for friends. And during that evening, the host amazed his guests by lowering the lights, fitting a noose around his own neck, and lolling his head forward, tongue protruding, over a bowl of blazing chemicals to give a ghastly imitation of a man being hanged.
Oh, well, that sounds jolly. What a fun dinner party that would have been.
Yes, delightful. Other than those sorts of displays, terribly dull. But John Webster's career was not as glittering as it sounds. While he had come from a good family and had been spoiled as a child by his mother, he was not at all wealthy at this stage of his life.
Too many fireworks.
Too many, yes. Spending so much money on fireworks. He was expected to live well, and he enjoyed living well at Harvard. You have to dress in the finest of clothes. You have to attend parties, the best books and cognac at your elbow at all times. But the family has lost a lot of their money over the years. And slowly the legacy that he had hoped that would support him is soon gone. And all he has is his lecturer's salary.
Yeah.
Ugh. Lecturer's salary anywhere else? Fine. That's a salary. At Harvard, no. One needs a legacy to back you up. It's not enough to live on and also to live the life of a Harvard elite. Sure enough, rumors are starting to circulate that Webster had amassed a few debts around town. And janitor Littlefield has seen Webster behaving rather strangely in the days that directly followed Parkman's disappearance. He had seen Webster at first carrying a bundle. around. Not a huge bundle, a small bundle. And Webster very determinedly saying to Littlefield that he needed a fire. He needed a fire in his laboratory. He has a furnace in there, a small furnace, certainly to heat the place. A few days after that, Webster had bumped into Littlefield and had asked him very directly if he'd seen Parkman at the medical school. Everyone had said that they'd seen Parkman on the steps, but had he seen him anywhere else? Had he seen him in the corridors? And had he seen him in Webster's office?
Or in my furnace?
Have you seen him anywhere near that or anywhere near this general area? Littlefield's like, no. And Webster says, oh, good, because I had just paid back $483 of a debt that I owed to Parkman, and he was right on his way to have that recorded by the city clerk. So he definitely did that. Goodbye.
Nice.
Words to that effect. Webster says this to Littlefield. He also goes to Parkman's family in the days following his disappearance to say about this debt that he had totally paid off with Parkman, and says, yep, he definitely was going to go and get that signed off. So maybe something happened while he was getting that declared. Walks out, doesn't ask about the search or if he's actually been found or anything. Hope he's fine. Webster has also been asking Littlefield about the dissecting vault in the medical school. How would one access that? What would be the lighting in there? But that area has been searched. After that, Webster chances upon the janitor again and tells him he's bought him a Thanksgiving turkey to thank him for all of his help he's been giving him.
Okay.
Yes, Littlefield's like, okay. And he says, yes, you can pick up your turkey at that shop. Thank you so much for helping me.
At that shop, very, very far away over there.
So Littlefield, knowing that he's got the authorities breathing down his neck and he is going to be labelled as a suspect, being but a lowly janitor in this school of elitists, he decides that he needs to do a little investigating. Okay. So just before the Thanksgiving holiday, where fewer people are around, he tries to get access one day to Webster's laboratory. He would normally go in there and set up and clean up and tend to the fires. He cannot get in there all day. Webster's there for part of the day. He later leaves. He cannot get into the laboratory. It is locked. And that is not heard of in the school. You always have access to it. He would have access to it. He goes there, can't get in. He feels the wall is uncommonly hot. It is burning hot to the point where he's like, okay, something is wrong.
Something's very, very wrong in there.
Something's
on fire.
Not right. He manages to break into the room using his tools. He gets into the office. He finds that the cause of the heat on the wall has been the furnace that has been lit to a ridiculously high temperature but has then been put out. Really, really, really high. All the kindling has gone. Lots of water buckets have also disappeared. So something has gone on with the furnace there. And he sees spots of water around the place, but he can't find anything. All it is that the furnace has been very hot. But someone is missing. So what he thinks, the authorities have searched all the laboratories. They have searched every inch of the school. But there's one area that they haven't checked. The toilet.
Okay.
The private toilet of John Webster's laboratory. This privy, which is basically a long drop, has a wall and a sort of void area behind it because it drops partially onto the river outside to obviously clear away the waste. But he knows that there is a void area behind it. He has rudimentary tools. Being a janitor, he doesn't actually have a lot more. He has a chisel and a hatchet. He has a hammer that he gives to his wife and goes bang on the wall if anyone comes looking. And he spends the best part of a day, split over 2 days, chiseling away at this wall.
Wow.
Chiseling away to try and get into the void of this area. Eventually, he punches a hole in the wall. He gets his lantern, cranes his head inside, awful smells, very, very dark. And he sees a mound of flesh and bones. So seeing that, instantly goes and fetches another professor.
Well, yes, I suppose so.
Good man. Don't investigate any further. Goes to a professor who lives nearby in a petrified state, absolutely terrified. Gets a professor. They call the police. Everyone descends upon Webster's office. And they search this space behind the wall. They pull out a pelvis, a thigh bone.
God.
And a partial lower leg.
Bet.
The remains of a man.
Yeah.
No head. No identifying features, but someone's missing.
So, yeah, someone's missing and there's bits of a person behind the loo.
Yes, not normal. They do ask the question, the police, to the doctors and the janitors, going, is this where you'd normally dispose of bodies?
Just, well, I've got to make sure. I've got to cross everything off the list.
No.
No, it's not. No, it's not usual.
No, we have an area for that. and this is not normally what you would. You wouldn't put it in a void and then lock it up and then lock it up. No, this is not what we do. That would be weird. So, words need to be had with Webster, clearly.
Yeah.
The police bring Webster in for questioning. It's slightly elaborate as Webster technically lives in Cambridge. This is in Boston. And so they have to kind of get him in the car and say, oh, no, can you just come in and help us with some stuff? And until they're across the lines and buzz, oh, yeah, we're arresting
you. Got you now.
When Webster is brought in, he pretty much goes off his trolley.
Okay.
He's indignant. Like, nothing to do with me. I don't know what you're talking about. This is lies. This is awful. That janitor, he's the one responsible. There are some reports that he says something like, oh, my God, I'm a villain. They're not corroborated.
Mm.
What he does do next is that when he's left alone in his cell, he seems to start becoming very ill. Limbs all tense up. He's can't stand up at one minute and then he's sort of rigid. It seems like he's almost on the verge of convulsions and everyone's like, okay, you're overdoing the grief a little bit too much here, mate.
Okay.
It would later transpire he's taken strychnine.
Oh, that'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not at all a guilty conscience there.
Yes. While taken into custody, he's like, that's fine. I will take my strychnine. Didn't actually take enough. So all he did was make himself a bit sick.
Oh.
And very suspicious
very,
looking.
Very suspicious indeed. Yeah, probably not the best plan.
So after this strychnine incident where he's no good to anyone, they actually take him to view the remains and he's just like, he doesn't seem to be helpful right now. But he still doesn't confess anything. Mm. He goes absolutely shtum. The police investigate the rest of his rooms, searching the lab. The authorities find traces of acid, fragments of bone around the room. And eventually, underneath a lot of his samples, they find a trunk that contains a human torso. And inside that human torso is stuffed another human thigh.
Oh, God.
So he's made good use of the space.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, with all of these chunks of human lying around, they still don't have a head.
No.
So how can they tell that this is Dr. Parkman? It's a body.
It's a body.
Hmm.
Yeah.
In a place where they study anatomy.
Well, this is very true. But not usually in trunks or behind the walls.
Not usually hidden around your lab.
No, indeed.
No. The means to identify these remains eventually come by two methods. One is that Dr. Parkman's wife identifies a birthmark on his back.
Okay.
And also his genitals.
Right. Yeah, well, she'll be the one to know what they look like.
Yeah, it's like, oh, that's definitely him.
That's definitely him.
Yeah. The police would also find remains of teeth in the furnace. And this is one of the first ever cases where dental records are used to identify a victim. Now, it's not actual teeth. They turn out to be fragments of dentures.
Oh, right.
But Dr. Parkman, being so fancy and wealthy, had a very, very special set of dentures made that could and so these remains are undeniably his.
Dentist had the blueprints.
They had them all mapped out. An expert is later able to prove this. In the press, the janitor is still being labelled as the killer, Littlefield. Because the Bostonians don't want to believe that Webster, poor as he might be, they don't actually know that.
No, well, he works at Harvard. He's still a fancy doctor, still a teacher, someone doesn't do such things.
Of course not. It must be the commoner. They comment that Littlefield is known to be a bad man. And that he only uncovered the body to claim the reward money, the $3,000. That's the only reason that he's gotten involved in any of this.
Mm.
So, right. So you kill someone and uncover the body later on and then blame someone else just to get the reward money. That's a bit weird.
It's a cunning plan, though.
The Webster is still in jail and still denying he had anything to do with the incident. And he is very happy also to point the finger at Littlefield as well, saying he must have done it. He has access to the lab. What will later emerge is that he has a close relative go in to the crime scene and loosen a door panel.
Ooh.
Once he knows it's done, he tells his lawyers, you know, you should really check out that door in my lab because maybe that's how Littlefield got in and planted all this evidence. So as was covered in one of the best books about this case, he's tampering with evidence.
Mm.
He's tampering with the crime scene to try and cast blame on this janitor who's done nothing, if anything, has rumbled him, has solved the case. So the trial would go ahead in March 1850. and the cream of the crop of the legal profession are there, as well as reporters from all over the world. The jury are allowed to visit the crime scene, and the defense argues that the body is not Parkman's. You can't tell us that it's Parkman's. We don't know. You can't prove that it is. But the prosecution bring forth expert after expert to confirm how the corpse had been dissected, to confirm that the false teeth in the furnace had been Parkman's. Mm. They have an expert who comes in and makes a mold of his head and makes a mold of various things and go, these are very much his teeth. These are his dentures. Littlefield gave his story on the stand and was calm and unflappable in the face of accusations that he was after the reward money. And then the backstory of John Webster emerges. Mm-hmm. And that may be time for another beverage.
Oh, good.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, Nick, we have our red hooks.
We do. Thank you very much.
Let us continue with the story.
Yes.
So it transpires that Dr. Parkman and his brother-in-law had both given John Webster a loan. Mm. A loan of quite substantial amounts of money. Over the years. And Webster had used the same guarantee method for both of these loans, which is basically fraud.
Yeah, yeah, you can't be doing that.
He had been lying his way through high society. Webster was desperate to keep up appearances, keep up with a Harvard lifestyle, trying to be the fancy elite professor he was expected to be, but he was robbing Peter to pay Paul in order to do this. He didn't have the means, and now things were spiraling. It would turn out that he had borrowed $400 from Dr. Parkman in 1842, and having not paid it back, Dr. Parkman presented him with a note that said, okay, this has now amassed to $2,432.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah,
that's a lot of interest.
The man is not rich just by accident. He knows how to collect his debts and his rents. Webster had ended up borrowing $1,200 in 1848 from Parkman's brother-in-law. Oh, but it only takes a matter of time before Parkman and brother-in-law go on a nice walk together and go, oh yeah, I've been, a chap owes me money. Oh, really? A chap owes me money. Is it, what? What guarantee did he use for you? That's the same guarantee he used for me. Apparently, when they're on a walk, they both bump into Webster, and Webster's like, shit. Parkman had chased Webster for the repayment and eventually had agreed to meet Webster at his lab at the medical school on the 23rd of November in the afternoon. So all of this is laid out that Webster was in debt to Parkman. A body has been found cut up in Webster's lab. It's clearly Parkman's, as the prosecution would have it laid out. Defense are still going, No, I don't believe it is. This is from an article in Forbes as well, Forbes magazine. Before the jury deliberated, the judge, Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, Lemuel Shaw, gave an unprecedented instruction to the jury. The standard in murder cases in the mid-19th century was absolute certainty of guilt. Under this burden, the prosecution would have had to prove conclusively that the body was Parkman's and that Webster had killed him and that he had done so on purpose. Judge Shaw, though, instructed the jury that they only needed to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the body was Parkman's. Whilst this phrasing has become standard today and was a part of European law for centuries, it wouldn't be until the 1880s that the US Supreme Court would discuss and define the term reasonable doubt. The judge says to them, just prove that it's, if you're certain that it's Parkman's body, then he's guilty. So you have a body, and it's a little bit of a flip on some of the other cases we have. You can have a body, but you haven't proven that I've killed him. Yeah, in this case, they're going, I think it's pretty cut and dried.
Clear, pretty clear.
The jury take him at his word. Mm. They return a guilty verdict after just 3 hours.
Yeah.
On the 1st of April.
Well, the judge has told them, he's guilty, hang him up.
They go in, have some sandwiches, a few teas, a few red hooks. Webster is sentenced to death. Now, while appeals were lodged and the press was divided in June 1850, Webster wrote his confession.
Ah, there we go.
Now, according to his story, he admitted that Parkman had arrived in his lab that day demanding payments for the massive debts owed. And Webster claimed Parkman was shouting and flailing all over the place. He claimed Parkman had threatened to destroy his career if he didn't pay. He would expose him as a fraud. He would rob him of his job. He owed this money. He was going to tear him down if he didn't pay. Webster, in a rage, picked up a stick of wood and struck Parkman in the head with, and I quote, all the force that passion could give it. The sudden blow knocked Parkman down and he did not get up again. Webster would say that he tried to revive him, but when he realized that this single blow had indeed killed Parkman, he decided not to go to the police and just hide the body instead.
Go to the police. Go to the police.
Yeah.
That's this has happened.
Manslaughter. Now it looks like murder.
Yeah.
So cutting it up, burning pieces, concealing it wherever he could in his office. This is fine. Mm. This is absolutely fine. Well, the law doesn't think that way.
No. Good.
There would be other testimonies about the body and saying it had been stabbed and people thought it had been stabbed in places. They were never really sure, but this was Webster's confession, that it was just a simple argument that had gone wrong, but he covered it up instead of admitting it.
So at that point, he's got no reason to lie, has he? Really?
He's going to hang.
He's going to hang either way, so he might as well tell the truth.
And indeed, he was hanged on the 30th of April, 1850. And apparently, Ephraim Littlefield, who was so wrongly maligned in the press, was indeed given the $3,000 reward for leading to the discovery.
Oh, God, I mean, he's... He I think that's fair enough.
Took the money. He retired. Traumatised, I fear.
Yeah.
A nice little end script to this. When Charles Dickens visited Boston... In 1867, among his first requests was to see the room that Parkman had been murdered in.
Oh, God.
That is the story of murder at Harvard, Dr. Parkman.
Very good.
And John Webster.
John Webster. Oh, no. I like dear old Littlefield. He's the hero in this one.
I bloody love that man.
Absolutely. Yep. He's out there going, no, I'm not going to be found guilty. I'm going to investigate. I'm going to figure this out myself. And he does it.
He does.
Yeah.
There's... A little bit of, while I was delving into the research as much as I could, and as you can imagine, you can only delve so far and it takes a very long time. And there's great coverage of this case. And there's some great sources that I will mention in the episode notes of this. Some brilliant books that have been written. there's still a little bit of a pause for me of, I don't think Littlefield did it. I'm convinced that John Webster did do it. But what was he hiding that he got in, he broke in, and that he knew where the body was in that toilet? I think he knew more than he let on, or maybe he was, maybe Littlefield was blackmailing him, or maybe he helped him. And
I don't know, but also if you're the janitor, you're going to know all the little sort of nooks and crannies and things. I mean, he's probably been called up to clean or sort of blockages out in that loo or something like that,
yeah.
and do all this sort of thing. So he knows all those places where the rich people are not going to pay two minds about, because yeah. they're, so perhaps he just knew there was a void. He just knew there was a void there. He just thought, well, that's a good hiding place.
I'm sure he was hauled across the coals at the time, and everyone was like, well, what were you doing in there, and why were you looking around? He was like, well, because there's a bloody missing man, and you're gonna pin this on me.
You're gonna blame me for this.
You're gonna pin this on me, so I better bloody find him.
Yeah, I'll do your job for you.
So wherever he knew, and again, you know, whether Littlefield was a shady character beforehand, you know, he knew where to get a body or two.
Well, that's true. That's very fair. Yeah.
Maybe he knew more secrets around Harvard Medical School. And
I'm sure, absolutely.
To his advantage.
Yeah.
But still, it got justice for Dr. Bartman. The rich elitist. Oh, the poor rich white men will never seek justice. But yeah, didn't deserve to die. But no. Webster. Oh, yeah, that was... troubled man.
Yes. Well, just trying to keep up and just... Was he not... Yeah, just living above his means.
Yes, there we are. At the murder at university.
Nice.
The oldie-timey kind.
The oldie-timey kind.
The oldie-timey kind. When you look up stuff like, oh, murder at university. Oh, God, that's awful. Yeah. No,
there must,
have
been
now.
Like some at Oxford and Cambridge. We'll have to go and we'll have to investigate some of those.
Oh, I'm sure there were. There are lots of weird stories. Absolutely. Because Oxford and Cambridge are so ancient. And yes, road trip, I'm sure. People, do you know some university stories of oldie, weirdy deaths and secret societies? All that sort of thing. There's a reason that Secret History is such a popular book, even though I hated it. Well, what do you think, people? What do you think of the story of Dr. Parkman and John Webster and Ephraim Littlefield? Mm. Do you think there's more to this story? Do you think Littlefield really did it? And he was a master of pinning crimes on other people and making them confess at the last minute.
Yeah, absolutely.
You never know. You never know. Maybe there was some other weird shit going on there. You know, there were all sorts of dealings about the dead bodies.
Yeah.
There was a system happening
there was
no one wanted to talk about amongst the elite.
Of course no one wants to talk about it. Mm. No one talks about such grubby little things.
No. They wouldn't talk about it at Oxford or Cambridge either.
Absolutely.
Maybe at Edinburgh. Yes, tell us what you think. Have you been to Harvard? Do you know the story? If you've been to Harvard, well done you. My dad went to Harvard for 9 months.
I visited Harvard.
Well done you. My God, you're intelligent.
I didn't study there, but I went as a tourist.
Did you stand there for a bit going, I could have
gone here. So clever. No.
Just throwing fivers around.
Because I was like 15 at the time.
Oh, yeah. Share more ideas of stories or local stories from where you are. Local university folklore and tales. Oh, we love a little bit of studious murder. Jump on the comments of wherever you listen to this episode and share your thoughts, your theories, and your ideas. But you know what? I think it's worth you mixing up an iceberg.
Well, you say that. I mean, there's a lot to it. And it's got stuff that you're not going to have in the cupboard. So...
Okay, you've talked me out of it.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, Underberg. It's not something that everyone's going to have. Not something that anyone's going to have, I imagine, unless you're... so, yeah, don't buy some especially.
I mean, yeah, you might have changed my mind there because a slushy drink is fun.
Yeah.
The ingredients in this, I don't think I would have noticed that they weren't in there.
Yeah, they're not commonplace things. So I'm going to say, what is your favourite blitzed icy drink? I mean, you've got the classic margarita, of course. But what else is there?
Ooh, let like me a pina know.
Colada. Yeah, because we say we don't do the blended drinks. So, and we're coming into yet another heat wave, apparently.
You know what? In my day, I've done a few slushy drinks with booze in them, and they are delicious.
So we have to, so let us know your blended drink of choice.
The slushy drinks, not necessarily high art cocktail.
I don't know. I think they can be.
Well, that's our challenge. We will find one that is absolutely optimum.
Well, so you just put in a bottle of vodka and WKD or something in a blender. So,
yeah.
So, yeah. Let's try and not do that.
Yeah, dude. Remember to join us on Patreon if you want to hear more from the Poisonous Cabinet every single week, as well as our extra special new monthly episode, The Case Files of PC Morris. And please leave us a review on Apple iTunes if you haven't already. It's really important to help grow the podcast. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the Poisoner's Cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are...
trying to kill you.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.